Welcome to Going Antiviral, the podcast for the IAS USA, a professional continuing medical education organization focused on HIV and other viral diseases. I'm Dr. Michael Sagg, professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and volunteer member of the IAS USA Board of Directors. Welcome to the Going Antiviral podcast. Today, March 3rd, 2024, we are at the Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections, or otherwise known as CROI, and we're speaking to Adam Castillejo, who's also known as, quote, the London patient, and we'll talk about that as we go through our interview. Adam is the second person known to have been cured of HIV infection. Adam, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here at CROI.
Yes, and so you live in Great Britain, obviously, with the moniker of London patient, originally from Venezuela, but living and working in London.
Yeah.
Perfect. So let's dig in, and just on your medical history starting, you were initially diagnosed with HIV in the early 2000s.
Yes, in London.
What was that like?
Yeah, that was a very different experience. It was like a death sentence at the time, because I think when I was diagnosed, I was told I was only have 5 years to 10 years max. Because let's remember, we just come back from the 90s when people actually died. Right. So it was a really death sentence. So for me, at that point, it was like my care providers told me, well, this is the outlook for you. Mm. And I felt that sensation of I have a lot of hate, a lot of stigma to that. It was a lot to overcome. But yeah, they gave me 10 years max.
So if, obviously, I guess, anger and frustration.
No, it was panic. I think it was my life was over. That's what I felt, because I feel shame. I feel like the stigma that people are stigmatizing me, hate towards me, because I've been tested positive for HIV. So that was a really... very dark time, but I overcome.
Were you in school then?
I was working. I was in my early 20s, so it was the beginning of my life. So it was like, I felt like my life was over. And I felt, scared.
Yeah. And when you say stigma is, I think, a universal thing that a lot of most patients with HIV feel. And the study of stigma has sort of identified two components. There's external stigma, where somebody actually says something or overtly does something. And then there's internal stigma, where you feel like they're saying things. So which was more powerful for you?
I think both have equal power. I think you felt the external stigma and your internal stigma. It was just a turmoil. It was like it was a twister just working around, and it was really difficult to navigate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was lucky enough to have a partner and people around me that support me no matter what. And I think that's the key, because at that time, they make me feel human again. Mm-hmm. Because when I had a diagnosis, I feel not human. I feel dirty.
Yeah.
Society make you feel that way. And then I was lucky enough to have that opportunity to feel human again.
Yes.
So not everybody had that experience.
Yeah. And there's lots of great places in London to receive HIV care. Mm-hmm. And they put you, I'm sure, on antiretroviral therapy.
Unfortunately, by the early 2000s, treatment, it was not protocol. You have to wait to become ill to start treatment. So you have to have responsibility to society and to yourself, because you know you're an HIV positive man actively. So you have to take the ownership and responsibility. That's a huge task.
Yeah.
Because you have to deal with your mental health. And on top of that, you have to be responsible not to infect anybody else.
You're an contact advocate. With you. Your own personal advocate.
Yes. So that's a personal journey you have to endure. So, and then retroviral medications came later. Now the protocols are completely different. Now, as soon as you've been tested and you've been confirmed diagnosed HIV, you stray away going to retroviral medications. That is the, we move forward for the last 20 years.
Right. So when did you start ARV therapy?
I think before my cancer. So it was really, really late in time. So almost a decade later.
Yeah. So let's say 2010 or so.
Yeah.
Something like that. So you start on antiretroviral therapy. And then did you feel better? Did you feel different when you started it?
I think it was a combine because I think it was together. I was in the process to develop cancer. So it was difficult to navigate at that point because, but it was easier, difficult. I think it was all that together, right. I think, for me.
And then your cancer hit. What were your first symptoms that you knew something might be wrong?
I think, you know, like a typical cancer signs, you know, fever, ache, the lower the weight, you know, but you don't know if you maybe have like a cold, you know, because sometimes people would have cancer, they have no idea the right. symptom because it's so similar to having a cold or to having a chest infection or ear infection, you know, people tend to miscommunicate that. So I think that was difficult to navigate, but when finally in 2012, when I was diagnosed with
So
cancer.
And you had lymphoma. And with lymphoma, those symptoms you just described are called B symptoms,
as opposed to A.
So was asymptomatic. How did your doctors determine that you had to have a biopsy, or how'd they go forward?
I think, you know, because I have to push. I have to ask. I don't have an infection. I think something more. Can we investigate? So we did it, and then the C word came. That was a life changing.
And how did that diagnosis feel?
That was a completely different death sentence compared to the HIV. This one, I have love and compassion. People want to hug me and say, "It's not your fault." But HIV is your fault. With this one, it's saying, "We're with you here. We're going to support you. We're going to do that." Compared to the other one, so it was, oh wow, it's two diseases, but with different outlooks.
It's a striking difference.
Yes,
it's very well articulated. So you go through, I guess, initial chemotherapy,
yes.
which is standard for lymphoma. And did you have an initial response?
Yeah, I think I have a good response to begin with. But unfortunately, my lymphoma, stage 4, was quite aggressive when diagnosed. But it's the most curable cancer. It's a 95% chances of survival rate with lymphoma. Unfortunately, I was not in the range. So I spent around nearly 4 years having chemotherapy continuously because I respond, but then came back, rebounds for 4.5 years. So my body really take the toll. So my mental health deteriorate at that point. So I had to combine HIV, cancer, and now mental health. So, and that was fear and the unknown because at the same time, shameful because you don't want to tell people you suffer from your mental health. So but you're already struggling with cancer. You already have select stigma for HIV, and you've been stigmatized by society. So you were like, how much can I take? And this, I would say, for me, was a roller coaster.
Yeah. And this, I assume, was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma?
Yeah, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but stage 4.
Right, stage 4. So ultimately, they said, for you to survive this, you're going to need a bone marrow transplant.
Yes, correct.
How did that get presented to you?
Yeah, but I think people need to understand, and is it really people to know that before we go into that, we fail to have the autologous transplant because we tried that and we failed. So sadly, I'm told, the statistics said people like you don't survive. You become the 5% who don't survive. So from the 95%, I went to the 5%. So at that point, I was sent to a hospice and I given 6 months to live in 2015. So wow, now what else? It's nothing left for me no more. But I did not take that. I said, let me see if I can find somebody else who can't give me a second opinion. And for the first time, I realized HIV worked against me. So, but then my new medical team, which I lead by Professor Gupta, Ravinder Gupta, decide to, okay, we take the risk to just to have the transplant because I was an HIV positive man. So because people need to understand, it's not a lot of data to deal with patients who have suffered HIV and cancer going to a bone marrow transplant for a foreign donor. So it's not a lot of data. So I went for more experimental, you know, like, let's take the chance. But you know, you are at risk and it's quite high, mortality rate.
Well, but you were led to believe it's 100% mortality if you just stayed in the hospice.
Exactly.
Right. So
I took my chances.
I don't blame you. And by that point, Timothy Ray Brown had a similar experience.
Yeah.
He was known as a, quote, Berlin patient.
Yeah.
And he had a successful transplant and by that time had a very good outcome. So
yeah.
Did you know about his story as you went into this?
I heard about his story. So I saw an article and I saw a documentary talking about his life. And I think it was really nice. But for me to get to the transplant, I just want to be cured of cancer at that point.
Yeah.
It was survival mood.
Right.
So I didn't want to die. So when the opportunity came, to say the doctors told me, Adam, we found a match. Okay. I was excited. And I said, well, but we think we can do you cancer and you HIV. And I went, wow. That was a eureka. It was like, wow, I won the lottery.
Yeah.
At that point.
So this donor also was CCR5
mutation. Yeah.
Deleted. Delta. So for the audience who's not familiar with that, CCR5 is a co-receptor on the surface of T cells that's very important for the entry of HIV into cells. And when that's missing, it's a relative resistance to HIV entering cells. So in essence, with a transplant, for your cancer, they get rid of all of your immune system, basically, and that we'll talk about that in a second. But then when they give you the transplant, the donor immune system, basically, it would reconstitute your immunity ultimately without the lymphoma. And, oh, by the way, you've got CCR5 negative mutants, and so you'll be more resistant to HIV coming back.
Yes.
And that's pretty cool. So the transplant experience itself.
I think it's important to people to know, as soon as they ask me that question, they offer me that, I always say yes. But for me, they start the responsibility to science. And I understood that it's an incurable disease for the last 4 decades. And to tell me that I'm going to be cured of HIV, that was mind-blowing for me. But at the same time, I thought, wow, what a responsibility. And that's the first time I hear about personally about the Berlin patient, and we were say we're going to try to replicate from beginning to end his study. So I understood now my responsibility to science, but we want to work together, the scientists and I.
Sure.
Informed choices. I understanding my developing. And that's when really the London patient really began. Kind of that period between the ask me about you're willing to take the transplant? I say yes, or without no issues. But at the same time, I thought, wow, this is life-changing. If we achieve cure, wow, for mankind. And I had to think about my life, but I had to think others at the same time. Yeah, it was a humbling experience for me.
Yeah, and I think like all frontiers in medicine, there is a partnership between the patient and the physicians providing the care and the science, and I think you're a great example of how that can work out very, very well. The actual experience, so I think a lot of people, I've had questions to me of, well, why can't you cure me of HIV? And right now, the true cure, that is eradicating the virus, requires, at least in today's world, a bone marrow transplant. And it's not as simple as it sounds, right? So what was it? How long did it take? Were you sick during that process?
Yeah. So first of all, if people don't understand, the CCR5 mutation is only present in the 1% of the Northern European population. You have to belong to that group. And people see me, they don't look at me like I belong to the Northern European, but my parents both have to have that kind of connectivity. So my parents belong to the Northern Europeans. So despite my appearance, that's the first, because a lot of people thinking, can I have that, can I have the CCR5 mutation? Can I cure with the stem cells? I said, no, unfortunately not. Because this is, you have to be matched genetically.
Right.
This is multiple factors. Right. So that's to begin with. For me, when I had the transplant in 2016, wow, I reborn that day. So I had to learn to walk. I had to learn to eat. I was a baby again. So it took months. I spent nearly a year in a hospital in isolation. So I had to learn everything back. So when people ask me, can I have it? I said, no, you cannot. This is the blueprint. This is the window to find a cure, a feasible cure. But this is no, we cannot put a population into transplant. That is not workable.
Right. And one of the, just to give some context to what you just said so nicely just now, the reason you want a genetic match is because you don't want to transfuse or put in, transplant an immune system that would attack your normal organs. So it's called graft versus host.
Yeah.
And you got to minimize that. You got to go on a lot of immunosuppressive therapy to get you to the place where they can infuse or present you with the new immune system. They got to wipe out yours.
Yeah, correct.
And so there's a period of vulnerability for infections. So did you have
the 100 days? That's what they call the standard day. 100 days. That's when you, that's the date you count every day, because that is you alive each day. So that's if you mark 100, then you pass the first test.
But I've got to imagine during those 100 days, there were some really bad days.
Oh, yeah.
We had fever perhaps and
everything you can imagine happened during the 100 days. But compared to others, I was doing better compared to all fellow transplantees in the wars. I could hear it. Yeah. But I was struggled, but I could see other people struggling even more than me.
So you come through it.
Yeah.
And you're walking again and you're eating again and your strength is coming back and you probably can start cooking again and doing all the things you love in life.
Yeah.
At what point, I know they came to the CROI meeting and they presented your case. I guess it was Dr. Gupta, and you were referred to as the London patient. And how has that been for you, being this notoriety of being that guy?
Yeah, I think, as you said, in 2019, Professor Ravindra Gupta announced me here, the London patient. So that was a year which we went to see the expectations of people, how people accepted, how people really excited that we managed to cure another person in the world. I think that time, it was a reflection for a year, but at the same time, I was still recovering. Yeah. So my team had to look after me because I'm still a patient, but we wanted to give hope. So I'm a proud Londoner. I live in London. So for me, we have to have a contest about what name we're going to use. We couldn't use the British patient because of the film. We went to UK patients and now it doesn't sound. So you've been like, the diagnostic was in London. You've been curing in London. I think it will be the London patient, followed by the Berlin patient.
Right. And there have been other patients in other cities who got transplants, but then the HIV returned.
Yes,
rebound. And I think that's probably because they didn't get transplanted with a CCR5 deleted mutant.
And I think that's the caution. So we have to remember, we have to have control expectations. Yeah. And I think that's what we decide, let's do first the London patient, just in case something goes wrong and we rebound. And we rebuild your identity. And then you have to live your life thinking you were, but you were not. You did, but you didn't. So let's wait more. So that year, before that was announced in the New York Times, we will do all the tests necessary to get there.
So lots of sampling of most every tissue.
Yeah.
And no sight of HIV.
We did find fossils of the HIV. That's the important key. I think people don't understand that the present HIV is not there, but it's fossils of part of the HIV is still there. You can find there in the reservoir, but that meaning is not existing HIV.
Right.
It's just they were there.
Got it.
Yeah.
So now it's 2024.
Yes.
And I'm looking at you. You look happy and yeah, you look you. Healthy. Are you able to do most of what you want to do?
I think people need to understand I'm still a transplantee. I need to look after my health. I think that's really important to the audience to understand that, because I think a lot of people think, oh, the transplant and everything going to have. No, you have a lot to take care. I'm immunocompromised. I will be immunocompromised all my life because I'm a transplantee. So I want people to understand that you have to work on challenges, but now have to adapt. So I don't know if I can be in a kitchen full-time as a chef, because I don't think I can do that, because transplantees suffer from fatigue. So fatigue is one of the key challenges of the transplant. And fatigue is a really big issue for anybody who knows, and people that are listening. Right. If you have a transplant, you know what fatigues look like.
Yes.
So, and you have to change it. So what I want to use my chef skills, now perhaps a more charity events, like a create a pop-up restaurant for charity. So people go into the restaurant or the pop-up restaurant and a private chef. So we raise money for cure research. I think that's, I want to use my skills in a different way, but I want to do that.
That's awesome. Any final comments that you'd like to make? I did have one question. I think that might be your final comment.
Yes.
As you're coming out of your transplant, you've already experienced stigma and hate with HIV, and you've experienced love and compassion with the cancer diagnosis and the treatment.
Yeah.
Where do you find yourself now in terms of how others are interacting with you?
Yeah, I think it's good to know that I'm still Adam, but people look at me differently. I'm still the same Adam. And I think that's what I want people to know, that I haven't changed despite being cured of HIV. And I had to navigate stigma throughout my illnesses, because it's plural, all the illnesses. But and then I find myself crossing the line, because people think when you cure HIV, the stigma will stop. Surprisingly, not. It's evolved to another type of stigma. And that people don't understand that I've been stigmatized being cured of HIV. Mm. And I'm working in campaigns to end HIV stigma, because it doesn't stop after a cure. I think that's the narrative. And I had to tell to your listeners, to the audience, that I'm the London patient. I was uncured of HIV, but I always will be part of the HIV community, always, as ambassador of hope.
Adam, thank you so much for joining us today. Your story is inspiring and educational for all of us. And I think we can all look at ourselves, and hopefully people in the community will ask the question, am I contributing inadvertently, unintentionally perhaps, towards creating stigma for people with HIV, and maybe we can make the world a better place by examining that.
Thank you. Because my eager for knowledge, I'm now being a CROI. This is the beginning, the new era of cure HIV research. And I think I want to be the trailblazer to move that movement, to keep the conversation going, because I've always been part of the community.
Well, you're a wonderful spokesperson, and congratulations on all that you're doing, and I'm sure it will continue into the future.
Thank you for having me. Thank you
for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Going Antiviral. Catch up on earlier episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, and check out the video versions of this episode and others on the IAS USA YouTube channel. You can find these links in the show notes, or simply go to YouTube and search for IAS USA, and there they are. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review Going Antiviral on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and is not intended to serve as medical advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the IAS USA or its affiliates. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, you can send it to podcast@iasusa.org to be answered in a future episode.